Okay, today is Tuesday, April 28th, 2015. This is the first interview with Rogers Hollingsworth. I'm here at his home in Madison, and my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Archives. Rogers, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, I am Rogers Hollingsworth, H-O-L-L-I-N-G-S-W-O-R-T-H.
Thank you. And that's perfect. I'm actually going to turn it down just a skitch so we're not too loud. As we've talked before we actually started recording, the first question is sort of very open-ended, and that's to give you space to talk about your early years, particularly as they pertain to the person you become. So if you want to start there, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Troy. Well, to me, my life has been a real mystery, and I've often wondered how I become what I am. I grew up in Anniston, Alabama, a very small provincial town, a post-Civil War industrial city in Alabama, in the northeastern part of Alabama. It was not in the Cotton Belt. This became one of the new industrial cities, as I indicated. And Anniston was known as the soil pipe city in America. That is, sanitary pipe was produced. There were a couple of steel mills, cotton mills. Therefore, there were a number of extremely wealthy families. There was a great disparity of income, social status, and the like. I grew up in this community experiencing a great deal of violence, racism, great poverty, considerable wealth, incest, you name it. It was all there. And for me, it was a very painful experience living in the world. My family was moderately well-to-do. My father was an entrepreneur. We did not have the great wealth. But in a community of this size, around 22, 25,000 people, one knew almost everyone in the community. And I was fortunate to grow up in a middle-class family. My father was an entrepreneur, and we had servants. We had what was called a maid, an African-American woman, who in many respects was more of my mother than my biological mother. This woman took care of me, and therefore I grew up being very attached to people who were African-Americans. We had a gardener, Jim Woodruff. In a sense, he was my playmate, and this gentleman died when I was about 5 years of age, and that was quite a it was quite a traumatic experience for me. And so throughout my growing up in Anniston, racism and the issue of race was very important to me. This was a racist society. And as I said, the issue of race was very important to me. And many years later, it was interesting for me to go back as a white Alabamian and work to a limited extent with Martin Luther King. My father and mother were not highly educated. Neither went to a college or university. My father, I'm not sure that he actually graduated from high school, but much of my education came from my father. My father was interested in everything. I was one of four children. I had three sisters. My father took me very seriously, and we continuously talked about economics, philosophy, religion. He was interested in everything. As an entrepreneur, traveling business people would come through, and he would invite them into our home. He would also, from time to time, invite African-American school teachers. There were a couple of African-American doctors and lawyers, and it wasn't unusual that they were guests in my home. That was very unusual in that age. Now, I grew up in an extremely religious environment. I cannot exaggerate the intensity of religion in my family. My father was Presbyterian. My mother belonged to what was called the Church of Christ. And there were these intense discussions about whether you could be saved by sprinkling, as the Presbyterians believe, or whether you had to be immersed, as was the issue in the Church of Christ. In many respects, my home was like growing up in a German gymnasium. It was there that I really learned to think logically and theoretically. I grew up being taught that God knew every one of our thoughts. God was keeping score, and if we didn't behave properly, we would ultimately pay a price. And so it certainly did not seem reasonable that if we had what I was taught, predestination, that if everything were predetermined, what difference did it matter whether we behaved well or not? So, but it was this religious environment and the guilt associated with Protestant theology that caused me to suffer so much by the racist environment that I grew up in, that the world around me seems to be so contrary to the religious principles in which I was growing up, that that world was very disturbing to me. And in many respects, I grew up thinking I was an outsider. And as I look forward in my career, I've continued to be an outsider. I've changed my research areas every 7 or 8 years, and I've always felt somewhat uncomfortable wherever I've been. I've lived in, I've been here at the University of Wisconsin since 1964, but I've spent more years away from Madison than I have actually been here. And if you count living in a foreign country as living there for at least a month, I have actually lived in around 20 countries. But I never left Alabama, or the South, I should say, before I went to the university. So in a sense, I grew up in a very provincial environment, but partly due to my father, I was always engaged in big thoughts. And my father was, in many respects, responsible for this. My father was a good man. He was not hypocritical in the tradition of many Southern religious people. He was very troubled by racism. He built churches for African Americans. And on a Sunday afternoon, I would accompany my father with his minister to these churches. And I loved growing up with the gospel music that I heard in those days. And but it was very troubling to me to experience the contrast between this intense religious environment and the world that I was also in on a daily basis.
So, can I ask a couple of follow-ups about
sure.
this? So, I'm going to assume, and please debunk it if it's not the case, but Anniston must have been a very segregated town?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you were an African-American and you were in the downtown part of that community and you needed to go to a restroom or have a glass of water, that was impossible. African Americans lived in one part of the city, whites in another. The squalor where African Americans lived was awful. There were not sidewalks. Most of the streets were unpaved in this community. Actually, African Americans had outhouses. I did, from time to time, go into their homes. The stench was awful. And so it was definitely segregated. At the same time, there were a few establishments, barbecue and the like, operated by African Americans. And a white person could go into any of those places, and indeed the best barbecue in Anniston was run by an African-American gentleman, Jeff's Barbecue. And so whites could certainly go into that place, but if an African-American attempted to go to a restaurant owned by whites, one might suffer extreme violence, certainly be arrested.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to ask here is, you talk about growing up in an extremely religious environment with parents who are two different religions. I'm just curious how they, or at least from what you know, how they reconciled the fact that they weren't, of sort of a unified religious thought within the family.
Well, as a result, there were these constant discussions around the dinner table about religion. And so this was a big issue, because it dealt with eternally the life hereafter. And were you going to burn forever in hell, or might you live forever in the land of honey? And so these were big issues in my family, and very troubling to me that God knew all your thoughts, that you could never really be completely living the right way. So to me, from early on, it was important to escape from that world. And but in the longer term, that's where my education occurred. I later developed and write about a concept I call high cognitive complexity. And that is, I think, the key to creativity for many people is that they internalize multiple cultures. And I was fortunate to grow up in a community like Anniston, whereby I, unlike most of the community, the citizens in that community, I knew rather intimately African Americans. My father, being an entrepreneur, employed many very poor and very ignorant white people. There were people who were very wealthy. And I knew all these people, and intuitively I knew how to interact with them, what you could say and not say, and so forth. So in a certain sense, I was internalizing multiple cultures. And it's sort of interesting that in a good bit of my later research on creativity and creativity in science, I apply these concepts. And so many of the great scientists I study are individuals who internalize multiple cultures. I think I got those insights from my living in Anniston, Alabama.
Okay. Maybe one more thing here before we move on. And that's, you talked about your siblings, having siblings. I know it's difficult to speak for them, but how do you think they felt and went through the same things that you went through?
No. I have three sisters. Two are now deceased, having died within the last 2 years. One graduated from university. The other two attended university for only 1 year. Two of them were never troubled by the race issue. The third one, a year and a half younger than I, she was a bit troubled, and I remember some years later in the Selma to Montgomery March, she contacted me. She was not living in Alabama at the time and wondered if she should come and join me. I advised her not to come because I thought it not safe for her, but she didn't feel the intensity of the race issue as I did, but she was troubled. I don't think my other two sisters were.
Okay.
One thing I've not touched on, and perhaps I should, is the educational system. My education, as I said, in many respects, came from discussions and debates around the dinner table, and from discussing things with my father. As I said, he was not a very well-educated in a formal sense, but he had very wide interest. Every Saturday afternoon, he would come home from his office and listen to the Metropolitan Opera. So the schools were very poor. Before graduating from high school, I had never written a paper. I could not spell well because I tended to spell words the way they sounded with a southern accent. There was y'all instead of you for plural people. So when I went away to a university, I'd had no experience in writing, and I couldn't spell well. And again, it's somewhat shocking to me that many years later, I've been the author or editor of more than 20 books. And again, I look back and have a lot of curiosity about how that happened. But I think, as I say, I think growing up, for me, in Anniston, Alabama, it was a very rich education to grow up in such a diversified world.
So, you know, you said that neither of your parents were college educated, yet you went to the university. So I wonder if we could sort of shift into that part of your life by asking the question, you know, why go to university in your case?
Well, it was always understood that I would go to a university. That was never questioned. The question was, I never gave much thought to what I would study at a university. In this world, many sons talked about becoming a lawyer or a doctor. One subject that I did study, in some depth in high school, was Latin. And one studied Latin because historically, a good bit of terminology in law and medicine originated with Latin. And it was assumed that I would go to a university. At the same time, I never gave much thought as to where I would go to the university. Not too many people in Anniston went away to universities, and of those who did, very high percentage of them dropped out after 1 or 2 years. And I was really frightened that when I went to university, that I wouldn't make it, that I too would be one who would drop out or be forced to drop out after about a year.
Just jotting down a note here. So if I remember right from your CV, Emory is where you went to?
I went to Emory University. It's quite remarkable to me that I made that decision to go to Emory, I think in June, prior to September, the beginning of the academic year. And if I may talk a little bit about my first year at Emory, it was an exhilarating experience. Suddenly, I looked back on it and I felt completely free. To be liberated from Anniston, Alabama was, as I indicated, just an exhilarating experience. I was quite surprised that I seemed to be fairly successful. I was never an outstanding student at Emory. Emory was a school sort of dominated by fraternities. These days, I have a very low opinion of fraternities, but Emory was very much dominated by fraternities. And in the fraternity of which I was a member, each freshman had a kind of a big brother who was a mentor. And I was very fortunate to have, as a mentor, a student a year or so older than I. He was, he would read my papers. He helped me to learn English and to spell. And so here is a student older than I who taught me so much, and I was completely indebted to him. But I was really frightened that I would not survive that first year at Emory. I remember the first history course I took, and I was taught very much by a teaching assistant. He had an enormous impact on my life. He was just so stimulating, and I learned so much from him. He never received a PhD. I'm told he later became an alcoholic. But thinking back on that experience, I've often wondered, what is great teaching? I'm not sure he had that much impact on much impact on any of the other students, but he certainly had a big impact on me.
So the Emory that I know is in Atlanta. Is there another Emory?
No, well, there was what was called even then a kind of Emory College, which operated in Oxford, Georgia. It was a two-year program, and students were expected to move from there to the main campus. Emory was, at that time, was a kind of middling university in quality. It was relatively small. It's now become quite a good academic institution. It's not in the same league with Duke among private universities in the South. But now Emory has a good many members of the National Academy of Science, and it now recruits quite good scholars and excellent undergraduates and graduate students. But it was a rather middling school at the time, better academically by far than the state universities of Alabama or Georgia and so forth. But it was a stimulating environment. I should say that back in Anniston, I'd had two teachers, one in chemistry and one in biology, and they were pretty good teachers, so that when I went to Emory, I was well prepared to study chemistry. I look back on it, and of course Linus Pauling was already one of the great chemists at the time, dealing with issues of the double helix and so forth, but none of that was seemed to be known by my chemistry teachers, but nevertheless, it was part of the opening up a new world to me.
Mm-hmm. So, was Emory at that time, was it all white?
Absolutely, absolutely segregated. And I was in this fraternity, and we had a gentleman who was a cook, and he was African American, a gentleman around 55 or 60 when I was there. And time after time, this fraternity would have financial troubles. And this cook would lend money to help bail out the affairs of the fraternity. And so I took the initiative to demand that he be made an honorary brother, if you will. And many of my fraternity brothers, as they were called, began to think I was a communist. And nothing was more outrageous. We had a chap whom I had arranged to be, again, a kind of continuing visitor and have free meals in the fraternity house. Ho Yan was his name, and he was from South Korea. And he was a graduate student in the business school. And after he'd been there about a year, I proposed that he, too, be an honorary fellow. And he, too, was not Caucasian. And that, again, was viewed as a ridiculous idea. And while certainly in some respects, I think of myself as a conservative individual, in that age of the Cold War and the like, I was considered by many to be a communist and a radical. And certainly if they knew that I later would be involved in the civil rights program, they would probably have expected me to drop out of Emory.
Is there anything else you want to say about Emory before we transition? Yes,
because I don't think I was a very good student in my first 2 years, and yet I'm still puzzled that in the spring of my second year, the dean called me in, and I'd never met him. And he said, "Rogers, Harvard University has granted us a scholarship to choose a student to go to Harvard." I was only to be there for one term, but I was selected, and I still have no idea why I was selected. And so I went to Harvard, and that was a major turning point in my life, to now come upon to have really great teachers. I look back on that just as being liberated from Anniston to Emory, now to experience Harvard. And so all along the way in my life, it just feels like I've had an opening of new worlds. And I've had this quest for learning. So Harvard was had a major impact on me. And again, I don't have any idea why that dean chose me, because at that time, I look back and I certainly was not one of the leading students academically on the Emory campus.
Do you have an anecdote or an example about your time at Harvard that illuminates this major impact you say it has on you?
I've always thought that students can learn more from their fellow students than from their teachers. One spends much more time with students. And one of the things that was so stimulating to me was, again, having classmates who were so bright and who had backgrounds so different from mine. But I learned so much from them. And some of them became lifetime friends of mine. But the professors were just amazing. Some of the leading scholars in the world. Professor Carl Friedrich, one of the great political scientists, Henry Kissinger's former professor. It was just so exciting to have to be able to come into contact with people like this on a daily basis. So along the way, I was retreating more and more from Anniston, but it still was staying with me every day.
So was that term in Harvard, was that
some? So then, yes, that terminated, and I went back to Emory. I graduated from Emory. The Korean War was on at the time. Actually, I was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to go to Norway. And at the time, it never occurred to me that I would get a PhD or become an academic. I was keen on becoming a foreign service officer. And so I had become rather broad in my geographical interest. The last year at Emory, I began to study Chinese history. The issue I proposed to study in Norway was the issues involving NATO. And after I'd been awarded the scholarship, suddenly it was canceled. And I never knew just why, but I thought it had something to do with security issues and what I wanted to study. So there I was in the summer prior to going to Norway, and suddenly my Fulbright is canceled. And so I stayed on at Emory to get a master's degree. And that was a good experience for me, because I wrote a thesis. I received my, I went to Emory beginning in January and received my master's degree in August. I obviously worked very hard to receive and write a thesis, which I still look back upon as being pretty good. And it was It dealt with U.S. relations with Japan during the First World War. Again, a rather narrow and provincial issue in the larger scheme of things, but it was an indicator, it seems to me, of my interest opening up to a much larger global world.
Just jotting down a note here. So, was that master's? Is that a master's in history?
A master's degree in history, yes.
So now you have, from Emory, you have a bachelor's in history.
And a master's degree.
Okay. Are you still interested at the time the master's is being finished about moving into foreign service? Or
I am, indeed. So at that time, I was given a scholarship to go to the University of Chicago. I considered going to several other universities, but Chicago gave me a fairly attractive scholarship. It was not a fellowship in that my tuition was not covered, but a fairly attractive financial stipend. So I went to Chicago, and one of the reasons also I went to Chicago, the chairman of the history department at Chicago gave some lectures at Emory, and he met me, and I'm sure he was instrumental in attracting me to Chicago. Now, as I look back on my life, it's almost as though everything that I've done along the way just opens up new perspectives on my life. And now Chicago just was a great experience for me. I had great professors. And the University of Chicago in history and the social sciences, writ large, was very stimulating experience. Within the history department, all the great historians were not in the history department, but I was fortunate to have exposure to two great historians, William McNeill, who was a world historian, and McNeill, I had two courses with him. One course, I was the only student, and McNeill would later win the National Book Award for his Rise of the West. He was a global historian, and in my judgment, one of the four or five great historians of the last century. And so to come into contact with a man like McNeill and have a one-on-one course with him was very exciting. Then there was Daniel Boorstin, an American intellectual historian, and I became very close to Boorstin. And Boorstin won the Bancroft Prize and also a very distinguished American historian. And I had two courses with Boorstin, and both of them, I was only one of two students. And my major professor was Walter Johnson. Walter Johnson was not a great historian. He was a great teacher, and he taught me a great deal. Walter Johnson was very much involved in American politics. And in 1952, Walter Johnson and a group of professors in the Fifth Ward of Chicago, professors at the University of Chicago, organized a movement to draft Adlai Stevenson for the Democratic presidency in 1952. And it was really quite remarkable what was going on in Chicago at the university. The role that the university played in national politics. And I wrote my dissertation primarily under the guidance of Walter Johnson. It was a study, it's titled The Whirligig of Politics, The Democracy of Cleveland and Bryan. And Johnson's influence was considerable, though Dan Boorstin was a major figure in shaping my and guiding my dissertation work. But at Chicago, if I might just say a few things, it was at that time a great university. There was also in the history department, there was Marshall Hodgson, one of the great historians of the Middle East at the time. There was Robert Redfield, probably the world's leading anthropologist. In political science, there was Hans Morgenthau, perhaps the leading student of international affairs in the U.S. There was Leo Strauss, a great political theorist. There was Sidney Mead, with whom I took three courses in the history of religion. There was Friedrich Hayek, who later would receive the Nobel Prize in economics, who was in what was called the Committee of Social Thought, which is an interdisciplinary program granting the PhD. In that Committee on Social Thought, aside from Hayek, was a great medievalist, Sylvia Thrupp, and John Neff, who also was a great economic historian. So Chicago was a very rich place intellectually in the social sciences and the humanities. Now, Chicago had a lasting impact on me. I was, again, for reasons I don't quite understand, along the way, I was awarded all the major fellowships in the history department. And along the way, I was asked to teach in the college. And the University of Chicago was divided at the time between the graduate school and the college. And most first and second year students were in the college. And so I was teaching in what was called social science. One, I was the only historian. And so I was thrown in with a group of very, very serious and distinguished social scientists. And this was very unusual to be, for a graduate student at Chicago's history department, to be interacting with social scientists, much less of this distinction. One of my major professors, Dan Boorstin, really frowned on social science. But again, this was very important in my education, because later I became very involved as a social scientist in my work in history. One of the things that happened to me at Chicago in teaching reminded me of my experience the first term at Emory, when I had this very stimulating teacher. One day at Chicago, the student newspaper is called The Maroon. And I looked at the front page of The Maroon, and there was my picture plastered on it, indicating what a great teacher I was. I was enormously embarrassed, because Chicago was full of people like Robert Redfield and Marshall Hodgson, Bill McNeil, Dan Boorstin, and I didn't know anything. I was really a very ignorant person. And that has also continued to cause me to ponder, what is great teaching? I obviously did have an impact on a number of students later when I came to Chicago. Some of the people whom I taught as freshmen later followed me and came to Wisconsin. But I really was a very ignorant young person, and yet I obviously must have had an impact on some people. But I felt so embarrassed to be singled out as a good teacher when I was in the midst of such great minds.
Mm-hmm. So when you were teaching there at University of Chicago, did you feel or know that you had any sort of teaching style? I mean, how did you teach then?
Well, that's a very good question for me. I've never thought about it in that formal way, because Chicago, as I said, was I was being taught in very small classes, and I think at Chicago I never had a class in which there were more than 10 students, and yet there were no formal seminars. That, again, is one of my strong criticisms of my education at Chicago, is that I never wrote what I would call a formal seminar paper as we did here, would later I would do with my students here at the University of Wisconsin, but one was very much self-educated at Chicago. One was expected to read and educate oneself, and there was not a lot of formal learning in classrooms. And so at that time, my style was very informal, but not in the college. In the college, we taught Social Science 1, Social Science 2, and Social Science 3. And these were team-taught courses. And that was very interesting because a group of these very learned social scientists and I, we would meet together. And we would plan almost each week's program. We would prepare a common examination for the end of the term. We would spend hours and hours debating and discussing with each other what that exam should be like. And so it was two completely different kinds of experiences, but I just didn't give much thought to it. I just did what I was asked, but I was never given any formal pedagogical training, and I just did what seemed to come natural and also very much influenced by the environment in which I seemed to be at the time in teaching.
What about Chicago, the city? By that I mean, where did you live? What sort of things did you do in the city itself?
At the University of Chicago, there was and still is something called International House, a multi-high story building built by John D. Rockefeller Jr. And it was primarily for international students, but a number of Americans lived there. I lived there. And that was also very exciting to live daily and have meals daily with students from all over the world. This was obviously attached to the University of Chicago on the south side. That area of the university was in the midst of an African-American community. There was a great deal of crime, poverty around the university. It was not considered safe to walk around the university in the evening. The downtown area of Chicago was called the Loop, some 5 or 6 miles away. I did have an automobile when I went to Chicago, and I guess that made me somewhat popular with some of my classmates, is that I was able to take them to the Loop or to Evanston. Living in International House, again, was very exciting. But one of my regrets later on is I was always so busy as a student that I didn't really benefit from the great culture that was in Chicago. At the time that I was a graduate student, I never went into the Art Institute. I never attended a concert in Chicago. My wife and I later lived in Chicago after I received my PhD, and I did at that time begin to take advantage of some of the great cultural attractions of Chicago. But at the time, I was just very, very busy. I was preparing for prelims. I was working on my dissertation, and I also worked on and was co-author / editor of a 2-volume textbook in American history while I was a graduate student. So I was busy almost 20 hours a day when I was a graduate student.
Would you mind talking a little bit about the book that you helped write in graduate school?
Yes, that was an interesting experience. So Dan Boorstin was a man who had a rather profound impact on me in a perverse way. Some of the great teachers in my career were those people with whom I disagreed with almost everything they had to say. And so I disagreed so much with Boorstin's thinking that he provoked me to go and read and read and read on things to try to understand his views and to work out criticisms of him. Now, he and I later became quite good friends, and forgive me if I refer to him as Dan. But we became quite good friends, and Dan had a contract with Holt and Mifflin Publishing Company to publish a textbook. It was to be an unusual textbook, a book with both documents and text. And but Dan, in the meantime, was a renowned historian. He worked. He had a contract with Random House, and Dan later would come to me after I'd worked on the project for a couple of years, and he said that Random House was exercising their right. That they had a monopoly on all his work, and he was not going to be able to carry through on this textbook. That was very upsetting to me, but at the time there was a historian, quite an able historian, by the name of Bell Wiley, that's B-E-L-L Wiley, who was a distinguished historian at Emory, and Chicago was attempting to recruit Wiley to Chicago from Emory, but he never accepted an offer and moved there. And so Dan worked out an arrangement with Bell Wiley that I would be a co-editor of this project, other than he, Dan, being so. So that took place. It was a two-volume project. It was very, very stimulating, very demanding in terms of time. And I was a junior partner, but I did most of the work. And sort of interesting as I look back on the writing of textbooks, I think it's a good idea to write a textbook when you don't know anything about the subject. It's a good way to get to know the subject. And it's sort of curious that for some years, the best-selling textbook in American politics was written by two gentlemen, Burns and Pelterson. Burns being a very distinguished political scientist at Williams College, and Pelterson, later president of the University of California. But they wrote this just out of graduate school. And to me, it was a great experience. I learned so much, but again, very ignorant at the time. But I was kept very busy as a graduate student doing that.
And then your dissertation, when did that become a published work?
So the dissertation, as I indicated, The Whirligig of Politics, I was working on, and there was never any doubt to me that that was going to be a published book. And so I finished my PhD in 1960. I began graduate school at Chicago in the fall of 1955. And as I say, there was never any doubt in my mind that I was writing a book. And so by the time I had received my degree, I had a contract from the University of Chicago that it would publish the book. And I think I did work on the book, revising it for two or three years after I received my degree. I had a contract by the time I left graduate school to publish that book.
So I'm going to again make an assumption. So at some point you shift between interest in Foreign Service and interest more in academia?
Oh, yeah. When I went to Chicago, I still had this idea of going into the Foreign Service. And it's sort of interesting that the first year, remember I told you I took courses in Chinese history at Emory. The first year I at Chicago took courses in both Chinese and Japanese history. Now, Chicago was quite renowned in Chinese history, particularly in pre-20th century Chinese history, quite good in Japanese history. And so here was my exposure, if you will, to a kind of global world, along with Bill McNeil later, this great historian of the world. I realized soon, however, that I was going to be an intellectual cripple. I didn't know Chinese. And the great Chinese historian Harley Creel, C-R-E-E-L, was one of the great Chinese historians, also great in Chinese literature. No one ever finished a PhD under Creel, and it became pretty obvious to me early on, since I didn't know Chinese, that I would be an intellectual cripple. But in the meantime, by mid-year, then I realized increasingly, I was turned on now. I wanted to become a historian. And I had learned now what history was about, the potential of history, and that I thought I had the capability of perhaps becoming a professional historian. I must say at the time my sights were, I had a low opinion about my abilities. Outside Anniston, there was something called Jacksonville State Teachers College. And I could imagine that first year at Chicago, well, maybe I could end up getting a job at Jacksonville State Teachers College. I still was, my reference world was still the world of Anniston, Alabama. But I had become hooked now in my ability to study history, ability to be a historian, and my horizon now had expanded greatly, and partly as a result of those Chinese history at Emory, and now certainly at Chicago.
So one more question I want to ask, and then I want to leave you space to if there's anything on your mind, and that's getting us to UW. So you end up teaching there at 64. You get your PhD at University of Chicago in 60. So maybe if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about what happened between getting the PhD and then getting offered the job at UW.
Right. So I was viewed as a very good student at the University of Chicago, but the job market was still somewhat constrained by the time I finished my degree. And I can remember May 1960, as I'm coming on the job market, as late as May, I had no job offer. And I had actually been, it's sort of interesting, the element of luck. I'd been recommended to two undistinguished undergraduate institutions in this country. I'll not mention them. But I did not get the appointment. And I've often wondered how that would have changed my career had I taught at either one of these very undistinguished schools that were liberal arts institutions. But then along comes May of 1960, and just suddenly I am offered two jobs, one at Yale University, another at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And these were two prize positions that academic year for an American historian. Now, I chose Illinois. And why did I choose Illinois? Because many people would think, and as they did then, that Yale was a place where one would want to go. But I did a kind of study, and that is, what happened to those people who went to Yale as young PhDs? Where were they 10 years after they went to Yale? And what happened to people who were at Illinois 10 years later? And at Yale, one is expected to be primarily teaching colloquial. They were sort of junior, I mean, they were more than teaching assistants, but they didn't get tenure at Yale. But Illinois, among state universities, was enormously wealthy. It had and still does have the third largest university library in the United States. It was in the state of Illinois, and it had a considerable money for a public university. It had one of the leading physics departments in the world, a great chemistry department. It was not so strong in the social sciences and humanities, but it was obvious to me that they would invest greatly in the career of their young people. And this was one of the tragedies of the University of Illinois. They were very, very generous to me, as they were to many younger people. And they did invest in me and gave me great freedom. I was on their faculty for 4 years. The first 2 years I was in residence, and the third year I had a postdoctoral. I was a postdoctoral fellow, Andrew Mellon postdoctoral fellow. And Illinois did everything that one might ask for. And then just suddenly, out of the blue, in my fourth year, halfway through, the University of Wisconsin offered me a tenured position in the department. And at the time, the University of Wisconsin was considered in the ranking by the American Council on Education to be among the top four or five or six history departments in the country. And my wife had actually done graduate work at the University of Wisconsin. So even so, it was tempting to me to turn Wisconsin down. I'd already had a job offer to go to Indiana University while I was, in fact, twice from Indiana while I was at Champaign-Urbana. But I was very grateful for the support I'd received at Illinois. And yet with misgivings, I came to Madison. And it's very clear to me once I was here that there was no doubt that I made the right decision. No doubt that I made the right decision to go to Illinois instead of going to Yale and to come here. And I would say luck had been with me all the way after leaving Lewiston.
Rogers, is there anything else about these years? And by these years, I mean the early years until coming to UW-Madison that you want to talk about now in case we don't get back to them in a subsequent session?
I think I've touched on many of the highlights.
Okay. All right. So this concludes the first interview with Rogers Hollingsworth. Rogers, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.